Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, it's that time of the month where we check out the talent in the latest issue of Monocle, where we praise them like we should, where we blow smoke up the outside back page of the November issue. What's in it? Well, it's Swiss-themed, but we're going to leave that refreshing part of the world to other podcasts and instead focus on good old Section C, which is short but sweet. I love it when it's like this. Easy to manage. So we'll speak to Chris Lord about his trip to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, which we've been calling the most liberal city in Saudi. But are we wrong? And we'll be speaking to the great Sophie Grove about her trip to the Yves Saint Laurent museums in Paris and Marrakesh, a beautiful thing all round. And because we loved her album Lost in Light so much, reviewed in short form in this November issue, we'll speak to the Swedish-Japanese singer Sumi about making that wonderful LP. That's your next 29 minutes, probably 28 now, so do stay tuned to Culture on Monocle 24. So first, out of the editorial traps, is my colleague Christopher Lord and his trip to Saudi Arabia's supposedly most liberal city, Jeddah. Now, we've wanted to do this story, any story, on Jeddah as an art city for a long time. We've had writers and photographers standing in the metaphorical rain, not a great metaphor for Saudi Arabia perhaps, waiting while they don't get their visas approved. But not this time, Chris got in. We wanted a story about artists, collectors and gallery people going about their business in the great Arabian Kingdom, but you wonder what you're going to get when you're on tough turf. Here's Chris Lord then on getting the story of art in Jeddah. Finally.
There's something to say that when I went this time, which was in the middle of the year towards summer, was a year to the day since the Mutawa, the religious police of Saudi, had had their powers clipped. Now, I have been to Saudi before in the past, and I have to say the second I stepped out of the airport, it just felt different, Rob, somehow. Like, you felt as if the shoulders were a little bit back more. You know, you drive around the city, you don't see that same sense of people shut away like it used to be. And it really did used
people
to feel
that people
literally
looking over their shoulder a bit.
Exactly, yeah. And I thought that brought, it used to bring quite a sort of feeling of suspicion to the air of Saudi Arabia. And I think, don't get me wrong, it's still Saudi Arabia, but I think the place felt perceptibly different this time. And so you step out, and it is, in many ways, it looks like a typical Gulf city. It looks, you know, big concrete buildings, and you're right on the edge of the Red Sea, which kind of gives it a sort of slightly more Egypt feeling. You know, you see a lot of those kind of those big palm trees with a sort
of a Riviera vibe.
Exactly, like a bit of Riviera vibe. Very different from somewhere like Riyadh, for example, which is right in the middle of
the
country.
Right in the sweltering
in the
middle.
In the middle of the desert, you know. So it's got this little bit more Red Sea feeling to it. But when you start to look a little bit closer, you know, you still can't get away from those essentially weird things about Saudi. The fact that you drive past a Starbucks, for instance, and the logo of Starbucks doesn't have the mermaid in it, because that would
be an iconography.
Yeah. You can't have representation. The only representation you see on the billboards is the king. There's no other people on billboards around you. There's just words and numbers. So all that kind of builds to a certain atmosphere, I would say.
And you went to do an art story. Obviously, those two worlds are in immediate collision. The no iconography rule and the world of art. I mean, there is obviously a lot of beautiful calligraphy that comes from the region and from Saudi itself, all the rest of it. What was your feeling? It's very much about the town of Jeddah and the country of Saudi Arabia as much as it is about making art in that city. But what did you kind of go off with in your head? You'd made a few notes in your notebook on the plane on the way there. What did you expect to find in terms of the art?
So I think it's fair to say, like, over the last decade, you've kind of heard a lot about, oh, there's something happening in Saudi Arabia. Suddenly they pop up in maybe an exhibition somewhere in London, or maybe even a sideshow in the Venice Biennale. You hear about Saudi Arabia. And what has happened as well is that every year they have kind of a de facto art week that happens, where they manage to get a few curators in or a few journalists in to kind of walk around, and they have a few exhibitions set up. And I think when we talked about the story, Rob, the whole point was kind of, what's it like when everybody's gone home? So what's it like in a normal week in the life of Saudi Arabia's art scene? And so I kind of went out there with that idea to sort of see, you know, what is it like when it's just a normal opening night at a gallery? What's it like in the studio of an artist when they're kind of working away through the week normally, when there's not sort of, you know, the representatives of Western museums walking around the city and so on?
People aren't on best behaviour. It's just a sort of the Saudi equivalent of a rainy Tuesday. Yeah, right?
Exactly. Yeah, just a normal week in the art scene there. And so, and that was actually the really interesting element of it. And I think, you know, you mentioned before about the fundamental restraints of working in Saudi. And as well, I think this is kind of really important, because in all this past decade, when they've done all these outreach programs and had these shows in Venice, as we talked about before, the reality hasn't changed. There are still Saudi artists in jail for making their work. There are still the fact that if you put an exhibition on in Saudi, you have to send all the list of the works to the official authorities who can sign
it off. With the pictures.
With the pictures. Yeah. So they know what they're going to get. And I think that is really important. It's ultimately, this story, I would say, the great thing that we've managed to capture is it is a story of people's ingenuity, despite being pushed down from the top. As in, despite all these limitations, people have still built an art scene.
Yeah.
And they've had to do it in any which way they can, like having a gallery inside a mega mall, for instance, because that's the one place you can't police people for gathering in public, for instance, in a sort of private gathering.
Amazing. Yeah.
All these things, I think, are really important to get a sense of. All over the world, how does art still manifest itself when you've got massive top-down pressure?
Well, I suppose it's one of those things that love will find a way. It's one of those things where art will manifest itself, as you say, in the most kind of like desolate of deserts, I
and
suppose.
And it is like
literally
that.
Literally metaphorical, right?
Absolutely, it is like that. I mean, yeah. You drive around and, you know, as I say, one of the main galleries there, Ather Gallery, is inside a mega mall. Mm. And you go from this sort of surreal experience of kind of walking through kind of a slightly sort of drab Megamore with all these brands that we know, and then suddenly you're in the contemporary art gallery of Saudi Arabia, who are navigating how to talk about a country where you can't talk about the country, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and now you mentioned Ather Gallery. The man behind it is Mohammed Hafiz. I met him at Art Dubai many years ago, maybe the second or third iteration of that art fair. Dubai, very different city, obviously, to Jeddah. But he was a man that kind of felt, without being funny about it, I was sort of surprised he was Saudi and the kind of things he was saying about where he was from and all the rest of it, in a good way. He was being refreshingly honest. Mm. A few years down the track, Chris, what's his kind of outfit like? How easy does he find it to sell Saudi art abroad, I wonder? I mean, he kind of feels like he's a bit on the sort of threshold, actually. He's
a bit of
a welcome mat to Saudi art.
Very much, and a kind of ambassador for what's happening there in a good way. Just on that point about him being sort of refreshingly frank about life in Saudi, about the situation in Saudi, that is what I like about Saudi Arabia's art scene, is that, you know, Rob, I lived in the Gulf for quite some years, and I did used to write about art quite a lot from a time when it was much more nascent, when Dubai really wasn't the art city that it is today, and certainly Abu Dhabi had no Louvre or anything like that. And what I like about Saudi Arabia's art scene is that, despite all that pressure from the top, it is some of the most outspoken art you can find being made in the Gulf and, in some cases, in the Middle East today. You go to some of those exhibitions and they are talking about what it's like to live in a place where there is an element of distrust in society, what it's like to live in a place where religion is so entwined with your rights and your opportunities to express yourself in a way that I think some of the other Gulf states, where they kind of allow a little bit more open free speech, therefore kind of the conversation isn't quite as daring somehow. You know, whenever you go around Saudi Arabia, there's a constant feeling of risk, I think. And I think that risk element is what charges the work there somehow. Even if it is still a little bit contained within a box of censorship, there's still that feeling that I don't know where the land lies. Yeah. I may get in trouble by making this. And that kind of charges it. But so that's one thing. But with regards to Mohammed Hafiz, you're right. He is an amazing ambassador for the place. And he has been at the coalface of getting this out there. One of the striking things about going to report this story is, you mentioned we've had writers before try and do this and be knocked back at the embassy. And in fact, we should say as well, trying to get in there this time for us was a nightmare. You know, we had, I think, three photographers knocked back, or
that's
four
right.
photographers,
yeah, yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So it hasn't changed. Even absurdities like women, unmarried women under 40 still get knocked back for their visas. So these kind of things, I think, are really important. And Mohammed Hafiz from Ather, he's really been there getting those visas for curators. This is how you build an art scene in Saudi Arabia. You get visas for the guy from
Tate Modern
to come over.
He's the sort of Jay Jopling and fixer.
Which we just can't imagine in the West anymore.
We can't imagine that being,
you know, we sort of think our governments want us as much as possible to, you know, for soft power and all this sort of stuff, to push our art scenes, to get more people to come for tourism and all this kind of thing. These guys are actively being pushed back by the government.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a tourist visa in Saudi Arabia. So how on earth do you visit an art gallery?
It's a funny old situation. You tell a wonderful story, of course. We mentioned three photographers kind of on tenterhooks and then being told thank you but no thank you. Mm. Some of our readers will be surprised, I think, at the pictures in the story, Chris. Mm. This is perhaps a kind of like a blunt instrument with which to judge the nature of a Saudi city. But on headscarf watch, I see only one in all of these photographs.
Completely.
And there's more women than men in these pictures. Is that something you were prepared for? There's a nice cafe scene here. There's an art dealer in their house here. I mean, obviously, these are women in private residences or inside all the rest of it. Should I be surprised about that?
Absolutely. I think definitely be surprised, Rob. Yeah, because, you know, the reality is I walk into those art galleries and just like here in London, good proportion of the people who work at that gallery are female. And that idea of women going to work in Saudi Arabia is a new thing. It all looks like it's been there for ages, but it hasn't. Yeah. It's a new concept. It's a new thing of young people going overseas, coming back with these stellar degrees and coming back and thinking, what the hell do I do for work? So the arts is bringing a lot of women into participation in society, definitely in a way that it wasn't like that before. But just one cautionary thing to say on that, though, is that, you know, you go into these galleries and you speak to these female curators who've gone overseas, they've come back, they're trying to help build the scene there. And you're chatting away to them and they, you know, they've been setting up shows in the Smithsonian and involved in stuff in LACMA and they're kind of getting work sent here, there and everywhere. But they can't drive themselves home.
Yeah, it's such a funny one, isn't it? I mean, this is set to change.
And it is set to change in June.
This actually happened while we were going to press, didn't it?
It did.
While we were putting your story on the page and we had to put in a little... an asterisk, I suppose.
And it is monumental, but it's still...
That's happening in increments, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, it's very incremental. Yeah. They can't go overseas without their guardian sign-off.
Yeah.
And that guardian could be their husband or their father or whatever, or a brother. You know, yes, it is changing. And the reason we talk about it in the article, the reason it's changing is because they need more people spending money in society. For so long, Saudi has managed to fall back on its laurels of having so much money because of its oil reserves that it can do whatever it wants. It doesn't need to worry about spending. It doesn't need to worry about getting people into the private sector. But because of this era of cheap oil we're in, it is having to change. And what this means, of course, is then that the arts become an opportunity to employ society. That's, I think, how the government is seeing the arts in Saudi Arabia. And so, as we talk about in the piece, there is this sense of change that, yes, the government's more interested in art. They're talking about opening academies. We started this program talking about the fact that you can't have the iconography of Starbucks, for instance. You know, if you still go and have fine art lessons in Saudi Arabia, you have to draw the copy of the Mona Lisa that you'll do or the copy of a deer with a line across its neck because you're not allowed to represent a living thing. It's insane.
Yeah.
So this will be liable to change, but right now, and as we talk about, there's a big cautionary note at the end of here that it still is Saudi Arabia. It's still a place where women are subject to a certain regime of laws that do not make sense when you start talking about contemporary art. And there is still a lot of repression when it comes to freedom of speech. There are still artists sat there in jail. Yes, it's a positive thing that's happening, but at the same time, the crux of Saudi hasn't changed.
So Jeddah, a great city for still lifes, not such a good city for life drawing classes. The story is called Hidden Talents. Chris Lord, features editor of Monocle. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Now, a potentially less complex brief is exploring the legacy of the late great fashion designer and the head of his own mega brand, Yves Saint Laurent. The designer himself was a byword for elegance subtly turned toward the modern, while his clothes and his silhouettes were said to set women free, if not just by being downright beautiful. But of course, it's very complex. How do you make a museum out of a man? How do you stay true to his vision, interpret his life and work into mere rooms? That was the job of Sophie Grove, reporting from Paris and Marrakesh, both the beloved homes and muses of Yves Saint Laurent, shared by his business partner and the love of his life, Pierre Berger. Sophie boldly went amongst Le Smoking to sift the legacy of Saint Laurent.
It was a very emotional space. I mean, maybe also because I went as they were assembling the collections and there was a real feeling of sort of trepidation, all these wonderful people capering around with silk black gloves on, holding these priceless artefacts, you know, jewellery by Lulu de Falaise and all these amazing pieces of embroidery. But really the most amazing thing about the Paris Museum is the fact that you feel like a couture customer. You kind of go in the door that, you know, you would have done in the 60s to kind of have your measurements made and everything, into this lovely salon with, you know, it's very ornate, actually, just gold figurines and beautiful drapes. And you really feel a sense of what was once this amazing couture network where women had to have a frock for cocktails and a day dress and an evening gown for the opera. And they really recreate that feeling for just, you know, your average theatre, you know, your average sort of ticket in a museum. It's quite an unusual sense of the past.
It's something amazing to be able to get you to sort of breathe in a little bit and stand up that little bit straighter, like you're going to have a fitting.
Oh, exactly. I know. God forbid they'd actually measure your waist.
It's only a matter of time. The pictures that go with your beautiful story, Sophie, are very evocative, of course, of the place of Paris and of the other part of the museum in Marrakech, which is also the Saint Laurent residence. One of the pictures that's my favourite is one of the mood boards in Paris. I'm sure Yves Saint Laurent had many of these, and I'm looking at something that might be a self-portrait. I'm looking at sort of birthday cards and things that have been ripped out of magazines and all the rest of it, and artworks or reproductions of artworks and all the rest of it. Does this magazine kind of put together the other 51% of the Yves Saint Laurent that we might not have known? Is that the idea of it, or is it very much about clothes? Is it about design, or is it about the personality of the man?
Well, there are certainly clothes, and the whole canon is there. And we just mentioned the Parisien, but he really did sort of invent, really, what people, Parisian women, are wearing today, the trench coats and a little, the safari, the smoking. But, I mean, what really struck me was that room you're referring to, which was Yves Saint Laurent's sort of office studio. So it wasn't his residence, but he basically spent his working life there. And it does have all his ephemera, and it's just a wonderful place to look at his creative mind, because there are these wonderful little pictures of his dog, little scraps of paper and doodles and beautiful amounts of sharpened pencils and glass, little paperweights and Christian Dior's walking stick. With a load of other beautiful walking sticks. He obviously loved a little bit of clutter. And the real sense, the way it's been curated, is that he has just left the room to kind of sharpen a pencil. And it really feels like you're in the mind of this man. This is where all of the garments were made. And there was a house of, dozens and dozens of people working there, and the models would sort of bounce along this white carpet in the calico versions of each frock before it was made in the beautiful silks and things, and he'd be there. So his library is an amazing thing in itself. Oh, it's stunning, with big long floor to ceiling French windows, and just gorgeous mirrors and artworks. He really had a sense of the world, all these influences, Russia, the Orient, just were sort of in that room in this wonderful way. I mean, you could spend quite literally hours in there, just kind of rooting, rifling through. So it feels like a real privilege that even exists. I mean, it's so, perhaps even, a sort of a point for other designers and artists, in the future, to kind of preserve that clutter and crazy sort of, could have actually been considered as mess in one moment, because it has such richness and personal sort of insight. I'd hate to clean it, because honestly, there's not a speck of dust on any of it. It feels like it's used, but it's been sitting there since 2002, when he died, of course.
Now, this story, of course, has a horrible sting in the tail for you, Sophie. You also had to go, while Paris was putting on its autumn coat, you had to go to Marrakech as well and see what's become the Yves Saint Laurent Museum there. Did it feel like going to another world, or do you see a continuation of Saint Laurent's design legacy and taste when you pitch up in Marrakech?
I mean, you really do. I mean, Marrakech is so crazy and so wild and chaotic. It really was his sort of alter ego in a way. I mean, he went there in the late 60s and bought a house, and then spent a couple of weeks there designing the collections every season. So once you go to Marrakech with that in mind, you really start seeing all of these amazing influences. And a lot of the interviews I did, people were saying, look, before he'd been to Marrakech, he was very much monochrome, very much the Le Smoking character. And after he really fell in love with the place, he just burst into this kind of riot of colour and became this great colourist, really. You know, the detail and kind of shameless orientalism of his work. I mean, it just is, it's all there in the souk and in the city. So it's wonderful to kind of wander around with that in mind.
You were talking about Le Smoking, and we think of Yves Saint Laurent as the master of these wonderful silhouettes for women to wear. One of the nice quotes, in fact, in the story, one of my favourite quotes, is from Christophe Martin, who says, Yves Saint Laurent, or Yves, was an artist and a revolutionary. If women can wear trousers without ridicule today, it's down to him. How do you? I thought that was such a wonderful quote to get out of Christophe. What do you think about that? It's quite an empowering thing. Saint Laurent had such a was a sort of quiet revolutionary, wasn't he?
I think he was. I mean, he was very sage, and I mean, it's difficult to really credit him to that degree with you know, the trouser wearing feminist revolution, because he was sort of influential in so many different ways. But I do think there is a lot to that. I mean, he sort of more or less invented the sort of jumpsuit, and he always sort of he really brought utilitarian sort of you know, naval style pea coats and white trousers into play in a way that really entered the mainstream fashion scene. And Le Smoking, I mean, the kind of idea that you'd wear a suit and trousers to a gala dinner is even still a bit outrageous when you see at the Oscars, you know, Scarlett Johansson or somebody. You always think, you know, I mean, one sort of does sort of think, oh, they've chosen to do that. It's still a political statement. So the fact he was doing that in the 60s, and he always had that element to his collections, is a revolutionary statement. He really wanted to sort of alter the status of women. But the crucial thing is, he made women look very feminine, very elegant in those clothes. And there was a sort of masculine style, but it was always this perfect tailoring. So in that sense, he created these clothes and made that political statement very, very, very beautifully.
Monocle's correspondent Sophie Grove there, whose story Worlds Collide leads this month's culture pages in the magazine. Now, if you flick to the back of Monocle, you'll find a few inches dedicated to my favourite music of the month, which this time around takes us from the ultimate indie duetting force of Courtney Barnett and Kurt Vile to the Aussie jazz sounds of the Ross McHenry Trio by way of a Swedish-Japanese singer called Sumi. Sumi is just about to release her second LP, Lost in Light, and I called her up to find out all about it.
And the far ends of a field, dark and fiery clouds rolling to a storm under my skin.
My whole album is like a short story of the time that has passed between the first album and the second album. So yeah, so it's difficult to pinpoint exactly like one emotion through the whole album, because it's been almost 4 years.
But did it end up kind of like the feeling you had when you started? Is that how you write? You kind of go, no, it needs to sound like this. You know in your head how a song or a whole record sounds at the beginning, and you know, and you carry that through to the end, or is it a process of experimenting throughout?
Well, it's both yes and no. Because the producer I had on this album, he's very experimental, and he's not afraid of trying things that I would never try. And sometimes I would say no, and sometimes I would be really surprised and go like, yeah, this is great. You know, I never even thought that it could sound like this. So it was great to work with him, because he introduced sounds that I never, that I would never try. You know, I'm quite on the safe side most times, which is kind of boring. So it's really great to have somebody go, well, let's try this drum, and yeah, let's try this, and you know.
Yeah.
I fought the first bad man. I fell the just floating, landing. I can feel my flat heels again.
I get the sense that it seems like a very literate record as well, and I wonder if what you read, or whether you listen to records while you're recording, or whether you read books, or whether that you... I think I read that you went to the movies a lot when you were making this album, or when you were writing it. Is that to kind of pick up little bits of inspiration along the way, like burrs on your sweater? Or is that... Or sometimes you have to kind of close yourself away from books and other music and stuff so that you don't kind of accidentally copy it or get too into something. When you're recording, yeah, and writing?
Well, since it's 4 years of all these songs together, but I also I'm a big movie fan. I think all the impressions you have, like visual impressions or as you read books or whatever, it kind of mixes up with where you are in life.
Yeah.
And it's very hard for me to write a lyric or a song without having at least half of me in it. Yeah, so it's still very personal. But basically what I got, the first song that I wrote was from letters that I found in the library from Second World War II and back, like old letters when people wrote letters to each other.
Yeah.
And there were love letters to like your mom or to your sister or to your husband. And they're so beautifully written because at that time people didn't know if they were going to be able to come home.
Yeah.
Or if they were going to survive. So they wrote their letters like if it was their last one. And they're so beautiful. It's like poems, all of them.
Mm.
And so I kind of... when I started reading them, I'm like, oh my God, this has to be lifted. We have to,
yeah.
This is like a beautiful archive of humans writing to each other. Like it's the, you know, the last note to their loved ones. So that's when Leave Me came, actually, mm-hmm. that song. And then after that, it kind of got easy.
The sound of your voice leads away from the
Lost in Light by Sumi is out on the 10th of November on Bella Union Records. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You can read all about the stories on the programme in the November issue of Monocle, which is out now. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Tune in at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound. And thank you very much for tuning in.